of communication. We didn't think we needed to put additional money into it. We also then decided to work through SANAC, the South African National AIDS Council, so that SANAC then becomes the main communicator around HIV. So that was the primary reason why we didn't use those funds, and that's why there's under expenditure on HIV. On the forensic labs and the coordination with the justice, the police, and others, just to say on the forensic labs, Honorable Member, you asked a number of questions around this. We have significantly improved the number of staff we've employed. The only challenge was that these are newly qualified graduates, and they need a fair amount of training before they can get fully productive and as efficient as possible. So there's a bit of a lag time between hiring them and retraining them in lab practices. With respect to the Joburg lab, I'm happy to say that the renovations are complete, they've moved back in there, and it's fully functional. So for all of the backlogs that we have in forensic chemistry, all the backlogs are being reduced, but clearly not as fast as we would like it to be. We are planning a new lab in Durban, so to increase the laboratory capacity. But that's going to take a while to set up as well. But we've asked Treasury for additional funds to set up another lab in Durban. Just trying to go through this quickly. With respect to the delays in vaccines and the high coverage, there was a bit of a problem with Pentaxa, with one of the vaccines, and that was a manufacturer problem. But what we did to increase the coverage is we had a catch-up campaign. So for the last 2 years, in February, March, April, we've had catch-up campaigns on the EPI program. And this follows a discussion we had at the WHO with the regional committee as well. The role of, as Honorable Dube asked a question about the role of CBOs and how we are rationalizing them. The ward-based team approach is what we have decided to do. The complaint, Honorable Chair, has been that, you know, government has many community-based workers going to the same household at different times for different things. So we've agreed then to have a more structured approach to community-based services, and it takes the form of municipal ward-based outreach teams made up of community health workers, a health promoter, an environmental health practitioner, and led by a professional nurse. And those 300-odd teams that we report in the annual report are those teams that are ward-based. And we've been training, retraining, and reorientating them to work in teams. On the postnatal care, a few questions on postnatal care and depression, Honorable Member. We do recognize that we are not doing very well in supporting mums postnatally. As we reported, we have just on the target that we've set of 60-odd percent of postnatal, of mother-baby pairs followed up postnatally. And we think that these ward-based teams will be a critical element in following up mums and babies postnatally. At the moment, the challenge is actually human resources, but the ward-based teams should be able to then track and trace each one of them. What the minister would like us to do, and we will be putting out a tender fairly soon to do it, we're just finalizing the specification. The minister would like us to use mobile health technology to register all pregnant women and their children after they deliver. So what that would mean then is that once registered, the pregnant mother will get messages sent to her depending on her stage of pregnancy, and also after the child is born, reminders to bring the child in for immunizations, etc. So he wants us to register 1 million pregnancies a year, because that's how many we have in the public sector. So we're going to put out a tender to use mobile health for that purpose. And we'll see how we go. In terms of circumcising babies, we've prioritized young men because we're doing it specifically to prevent HIV transmission. So in terms of our capacity, I mean, that's really the priority. I think it was Honorable Dudley that asked that question. In terms of MMC and enjoying sex later in life, Chair, the evidence suggests that it does not impact on quality of sexual relations. suggest it increases either. But and then the last question, Chair, is what's the difference? Why such a big difference between how many condoms, male and female condoms, we distribute? It's really a factor of cost. So male condoms, on average, cost about 24 cents each. Female condoms cost about, on average, 8 rands each. Now, that's not a good excuse. So what we have then done is, if you look at our APP for this year, we've doubled the amount of female condoms we distribute. It's gone up to 12 million, and we hope to double it again in the MTF. So you know, that's really what the plan is. Thanks, Chair.
You've given me something that I wanted, but I didn't ask. This one of why the females are lower than the males. But the question was, how do you decide how many condoms do you need for such a population? What informs you that 400 million is going to be good for 40 million people? How do you decide that? But it might be a difficult question. That is something. Okay, you cannot.
So what you did on the male condom side, we looked at what the best evidence is, and the best evidence comes from Khayelitsha. Khayelitsha was able to show that if they give 90, on average, 90 condoms per male between 15 and 49 annually, they were able to show a significant reduction in STI transmission. So we used that as a benchmark. We will not be giving more than 50 per male per year. So we then computed that back and said, well, the minister is also not keen that we use 49 because the assumption is that people after 49 years don't have sex. And clearly that's not the case. A male does. So we use that to compute how many sexual acts on average people from 15 to 65 have, and came up with the number of 1 billion male condoms that we should be distributing to have an impact on STI transmission and HIV transmission. But the best evidence we have is from Khayelitsha, you know, that says a direct relationship with the transmission of STI. The female condoms, it's a question of funding.
Thank you very much, Sergei. Members, that those were the responses. I know you didn't say anything, Dennis, so you should be the first one, followed by Honorable Khanada, and then I think everybody is going to be very interested.
Thank you very much for a very informative presentation. All have learned so much. Just wanted to make a couple of comments. I have had numerous phone calls from a company in Turkey wanting to sell a particular device for circumcision. Of course, I could only refer them to other people. But I'm just wondering whether you are investigating devices that are available from all over the world, and I think this would certainly help. And I think just making it known, you know, that it is available, and not only at puberty or later, because it's so much less painless. I mean, you know, it's just not a traumatic thing when you have it done at birth. Certainly recommended for my family anyway. And, so I just want to know about that. And then about performance management. This seems to be a big problem because it is such a diverse department as well. I just want to know what performance management system you have to measure staff and to manage and just to check on their performance generally and on their delivery. Do you have a system? Is it a diverse one, or is there one system that might work throughout the country? And then do you as a department feel that you have the capacity to manage projects properly? And I think this ties up with having a proper system which can be evaluated. I'm terribly excited to hear about the cell phone technology as well. Telemedicine is something that I've always thought is vital. And could you perhaps give me some information about telemedicine generally, especially considering the vast rural areas we have? And it's fantastic that cell phones are available to everybody virtually in the furthest areas. Yeah, I think that was it. Oh, and then about the TB in the Western Cape. Could I just mention one other additional factor that I think makes TB so high here in the Western Cape, is that we have winter rainfall. And the winter rainfall is really something that causes, and I work on the farms and I know the area here, that children just have colds so often. And I think this exacerbates the situation, whereas in the colder, I mean, in the warmer climates, you have your rainfall in summer. Okay, I think that's it for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Bekhalita.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. With this lot of questions, you must know that you have done your work. And we have done our work. We have read and understand. And I'm happy that you are taking us very seriously, because at a certain stage I don't. But I will take your word for it. Dr. Pile, devolution of power either to municipality or to province. Like you have, Honorable Dube was talking, some belong to local, some belong to province. And there is a problem. Can you read? Because initially it was shift from provincial government to local municipality because of funds. After OSD is another shift. Can I know that you are going to tell me about FALCA. And I really want to know your work. NHLS, KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. Since I got here, we were told that they have been owed by KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. And the problem is at a certain stage, there is this flat rate, and we were talking about it. Now, my point, I was asking them, if they are paying you that flat rate and they were owing, instead of paying you 95 million, they are paying you 45. But on the other hand, they are still using you. How do you manage? I know that the minister is doing something, but really this thing must really have a closure at the end of the day. Then, review, the financial review, because at the end of the day, I think with a quarterly or monthly review, I think, I don't know where to, is it quarterly or monthly financial review, you can detect if you are going to underspend or to overspend and do something about it. Now, I want to know, are you really doing the financial review, and really the issue of having a common primary health care, it is long overdue, Dr. Pile. The issue of this name, whereby the others they are doing, they are saying sub-district managers, the others they are saying primary health care managers, it's really long overdue. You see the shift, you find that CEO in Moses Kotane will move to Gauteng because of this disparity. We are in one South Africa and we are crying that the rural must have potential people. Now, if we are not doing anything about it, it's going to really affect these people. People are living. And I will talk with you after this, the supervisor. I don't know what you call it, their diary. I want to know if because I do my oversight at my office. But at the end of the day, I would say that there is an improvement. I know which tunnel I am. It's only Kanare who doesn't know which tunnel. And I know why she doesn't know which tunnel she is. I can see a light on the other side. Thank you, Chair.
I think the diary, I think it was a breastfeeding diary, because you keep it in your breast. I'm not sure about those who don't have breasts, but others with them. I'm trying to interpret what was said. You know, at some stage, on the comment of TB and Western kids, at some stage, but I'm still not convinced that TB is highest in the Western Cape. I've always been having this belief that it's because we're not reaching every household. I think there are other provinces that probably might be. I don't know. I'm just guessing. But I'm going to engage Denise on this one of rain and TB. I'm going to engage separately, not from here, not from the meeting. The rain and TB, and the winter and the summer. Mzala, I don't think you had your hand up. Let's go to Ndadehana.
I thought you would explain this issue of the number of condoms properly. That when you are 15 to 14, 45, you have got your ration. Your ration is so big. You have a year. But when you are over that age, you can do whatever you want. Your ration is more. so that it is properly understood. But you are in a different province. Look, when you talked about, I mean, the explanation which I would have given about Limpopo and Eastern Cape, the problem is that after we visited Eastern Cape, they came here. And they repeated the same problems they repeated there. So let me take your word for it, that they don't really need this money. Can you assure me that when next time I go to Nessiness, those buildings will be proper buildings, that infrastructure, because it's safer to work under the tree there than to work inside the building. So if you assure me that, because there's something in terms of sitting in the office and talking and going there and seeing what's happening. So what I want is not just that they must get money. What I want is to see that particular infrastructure being proper infrastructure. Whether it is with the money they have or additional money, it doesn't matter. But what I don't want is for them to give me an excuse that the reason why this the situation is like this is because National decided that they are not going to give us the money. So what I'm actually saying is that can we identify the problems which are there in the Eastern Cape and say, with the funds you have, here is a program to resolve those particular problems. Number two, as far as Section 100 of Limpopo, can I be assured that Limpopo being under Section 100 and the department playing a very important role as far as that is concerned, that there is now an improvement in the provision of quality health care in Limpopo. That's really what I want. It's not whether they have got 1 million or 2 billion rand. It's whether whatever you have given them, if I go there, will not be told that there is no, there are no sheets, there is no tablets, there is no food. Will be told that everything is being run properly. That's really what I want. It's not an argument about whether there's enough money or not enough money. It's whether the money which is there is delivering what needs to be delivered. On the thinking about the new medical school, what I wanted to check is whether because sometimes when you talk about medical schools, you only think about doctors. But in health, there are other health workers other than doctors, medical doctors. Are we thinking about ensuring that medical school produces skilled and enough healthcare workers? But also, you can't have a medical school without having lecturers. Whether we have got a program through which we are, for lack of a better word, we are going to produce enough lecturers who will be able to ensure that the training takes place in that particular new medical school. I know it's still being thought about, but I was under the impression that it's going to be at the Limpopo, University of Limpopo, or something like that. Whether we have had discussions with, I don't know whether the health sector education authority is still in existence,
because there have been so many fights and courts involving these sex education authorities, and I don't know. But if it is there, how are we tapping into it together with the skills levy? How are we tapping into the two to be able to ensure that skills development is properly financed? If not, I think it would be one of your recommendations to make that we have got to look at. Unfortunately, madam, there is nothing off the record here. Once you say it, it's on record. The private medical school, I'm finding it very difficult because you gave reasons, but all those reasons can be punched holes. But there might be other things which you have considered. But I really believe that if people can have a private medical school, and there are people who can afford, as long as the government does not subsidize it, as long as people don't create it and expect that the government will pay 50%, because they will say that we are producing for this country, because they will not be producing for the country. They will be able to get students from all over the world if they can do that. Why do we stop them? Because if we can get students from outside the country who are able to pay, we will be able to produce them. It will not be the problem of the government about how they pay their lecturers, where they get their lecturers and all that, and the equipment. I really would want to engage on that at one point, I mean, because I believe it's wrong to just throw it out. I think we have got to put it also and discuss it. Under NLHS, the issue of the cancer register is an issue which is which comes up now and then, but we don't find conclusion about when is this going to be properly implemented and then run. And the NHLS, when they came to see us, they talked about the number. They were very proud about the number of publications, research publications which were produced by them and all that. I just wanted to check whether those publications are linked somehow with the MRC and whether when we talked about the health workers, we were told about colleges, nursing colleges, which are going to be opened and all that. I just wanted to check that by now, since we started talking about that, how is the intake of those particular colleges? Because the problem was that Western Cape was proud that they are producing a lot of nurses and they don't have space, they cannot absorb them. So they want other provinces to take them. And Eastern Cape says, no, we also produce this enough, but we are unable to absorb them, you know. I think your response on the supply and demand, whether we have got, are we having enough nurses in this country? Personally, I don't see any problem of exporting skilled labor if you have got surplus of skilled labor, because you ultimately get the money back through what they earn when they are outside. So I've never been anti-people, skilled labor being produced in abundance and then be supplied to other places where they have got to be supplied. The question you did not answer mine was, why is your target for baby-friendly health facilities so low in terms of what I think? So that's my last question.
Thank you, Dr. Fanada. Honorable Koponya, the last one.
I forgot to jump to one.
Talk beforehand.
If she agrees.
Yeah, she agrees.
Yeah. agree. Thank you very much for agreeing silently. But when you talk about Cuban doctors, you said you are producing consistently about 80. So when I calculate the years, you must be having about 640 doctors, Cuban doctors now. You don't have to answer now, but can you give us at least a written breakdown of where these doctors are, these 640 doctors are? Now,
thank you. Before you come in, Honorable Khan, I know there's one who's specializing in neurology. He's at Medunsa as I'm talking. But he's got a problem because the Eastern Cape is not paying his salary from February this year. I think I'll need to give you the name. He has not been paid since February. Yet he's supposed to be paid. He doesn't get a salary, but he's continuing. It's from Eastern Cape. It's a mail. It's a mail. Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure why the gender. Okay. But I'll ask outside the meeting. I'll ask outside the meeting about that. Okay, Honorable Copan.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to make a follow-up regarding the Cuban student doctors. According to the presentation, as a country, we never communicated with other countries except Cuba. I want to find out why are we not... Are we not willing to talk with other countries, which they might also offer the same privilege that like the Cuban doctors? Have we ever tried? Why are we not trying other foreign countries in the Europe or whatever? Why are we only focused? I do understand you want African continent, but sometimes what happens if maybe any one of the European countries say that we are willing to offer the same service? Why are we not willing to do so? The other question, Chairperson, is regarding. According to the presentation here, it clearly says that cervical cancer screening coverage rate is 55%. The target was achieved. That is good. But as where I'm sitting right now, when I went to different clinics, especially in the Free State, they don't have the equipment. There's not even a system which can do a pap smear. So I'm asking where the cervical cancer, where the screening has been done. In terms of NGOs, I want to find out, are we making use of other NGOs like Cancer Association? I used to work for Cancer Association, but it was never utilized. And the Cancer Association, it was always willing to do the cervical screening. If maybe you can answer that. My other question, Chairperson, is regarding our public entity, especially South African Nursing Council. Many times, the complaints that we receive as public representatives is about the conduct of our nursing personnel in hospitals. I just want to find out the department, what is it that they are doing to monitor the performance of these public entities? Because in a way, they are also failing us. I'm a nursing sister by profession. Every time we were worried about your epilepsy because there was a discipline. But nowadays, people, they continue to do what they want with patients, and they just manage to get away with murder. But from your department, I want to know, what are we doing to assess the impact of the South African Nursing Council? My other last question, Chairperson, is regarding the transfer of funds to non-profit institutions and conditional grants. It shows here that the business plan for the utilization of the forensic pathology grant and the comprehensive HIV grant were allocated to all provinces prior to the approval. Why? Because we didn't comply as required by the Division of Revenue Act. Why did we do so? Is there any reason behind that? Thank you.
Thank you very much. She was the last one, unless there's another hand. But we don't want to box it down because we know we are tired now. So I think this is enough for the day. If you could just respond to those, I suspect at the end, Jürgen, you'll summarize, depending who's supposed to answer the questions, and then we'll try and close the meeting.
So, Chair, with your permission, we'll ask Ms. Natsal to start, and we'll just keep coming down this way.
Thanks, Chair, and Honourable Ministers. The first question... The planning for this is still in a very rudimentary stages. It is a thought that has been just put on paper. And as far as I'm aware, it was strictly the concern was about doctors.
simply because other professionals can be accommodated in other training institutions. I don't think that door is closed, though, because I think as the feasibility study continues, it is possible to come to a conclusion that other professionals should or must also be trained there. But for now, the thought was just for medical training because of the deficit we have in the country. The second question was about why the private medical school. Honorable, it can go on record, that I don't mind. I was just saying it was unofficial because that is, I was sent on an unofficial mission. Fortunately, the minister followed up too, but we had come independently to the same conclusion. This is a proposal that was put forward by a Dubai-based Indian company because they've opened a medical school in Dubai, extremely expensive, state-of-the-art school with all the bells and frills you can think of. Now, the very issues that you are raising are part of the issues why we thought it wouldn't be appropriate for South Africa. The issues of, you know, it's not... When I said we came to the conclusion that it was more a commercial enterprise than a genuine attempt to produce professionals, is that the model they use is they would have the school in South Africa, but only allocate, I think, 20% of the places to South Africans, but attract, people from the oil-rich countries, that's what it's meant to do, oil-rich countries who cannot be accommodated in their own universities, because as you know, most of the oil-rich countries have got small populations, so a university, a medical school is not viable in those places. So the model they were using is that we just provide the base, we just provide the venue, but really it's not to benefit. And the way it is structured in terms of content and also in terms of just social stratification, it is completely inappropriate for South Africa. So that's why it's three independent evaluations that we didn't even know about. I was asked to go there. Little did I know that the ambassador, they'd already approached the ambassador and he had come to the same conclusion. When I went there, I came to the conclusion, wrote my report, and I found it coincided with what the ambassador said. And before I could even give to the minister was invited for something or other there, and they took him to go and see this. And it was not appropriate. I mean, I think that's the best way I can. And it was not going to solve our problems, because if we are going to be allocated only a small percentage of places, we want big numbers at the stage of future right now. The Cuban doctors, the breakdown that I will provide happily provide. We track them very, very closely. So that is easy to give, honourable member. And then the training in other countries other than Africa. I think I did say that we have thought about that, we had looked at it, but the reason we wouldn't go even beyond Africa was because every other place was far more expensive than we could ever afford. We would never be able to justify why we would take them to Australia or England or Europe, yes, whatever, Europe, at a cost that could actually, cumulatively, could build another medical school in South Africa. So we just discounted that. Africa would have been probably be affordable, but there's no space anywhere in Africa for students to come. And then there are also issues of curriculum. In the US, for instance, there's quite a difference between the medical curriculum, even though we could actually match it to the South African curriculum in the same way that we do the Cuban in the last year. But the costs are just prohibitive in some of these countries. So that's why we didn't think of taking them anywhere else, primarily because of costs. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Just to make some comments on this private medical school. I think the worry with the private medical school, which I would be worried about, is that if it's a private medical school, maybe it's what you have said, you don't consider this, I mean, the quality of what you are going to produce, but you consider the money that you are going to get. In fact, most of the private medical schools somewhere, they will take you with whatever symbols that you have. And some of the people that come out of those medical schools, I don't want to say they are useless, but they are not up to standard. But at the same time, you know, in a democratic dispensation, you've got that feeling that even if something you think is not going to be good, why don't you throw it out to the public so that they can give you an idea as what they think about it? Because I think it should be a public good to say, does the community of South Africa want it or not? You just throw it out before you close it up and say, no, it won't work. Because we might be having different thinkings, but it's something that one was thinking. And at the same time, you know, a fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. If you've got a medical school, even if most of them are going to leave, even if they're from outside, they'll end up like in South Africa, they'll end up sitting here in South Africa. It always happens like that. If you've got a medical school in Cape Town, you find that most of those who qualified, even if they were coming from Eastern Cape, they end up staying in Western Cape. So those are some of the comments that I just wanted to talk about. Maybe that Untare Khanada said to Umeko Pane agreed in silence. But Dr. Khanada, do you know the difference between a politician and a female?
A female.
If you talk to a female and she says, no, I'll consider it tomorrow, take it that it has happened. But if you talk to a politician and the politician says it will happen tomorrow, it will never happen. Okay, I'm not sure who's the next one yet.
Now we get surprised when I ask about which gym.
Thank you, honorable members. I will respond to the issue related to PMDS, and I will touch on NHLS, Dr. Play, then you can conclude, and then a bit of Section 100. Yes, ma'am, we do have a system. The system that we are using for performance managing the staff is the Public Service Administration system. It's the same system across the government departments. So that is the one we are using. However, in the health department at National, we developed our own e-appraisal system, which actually also assists us to monitor lower levels. Because largely, the PMDS that was developed by DPSA caters for senior management, or from middle to senior management. And it was not assisting us with operational staff. So we've developed our own, and it seems to be working for now. Okay, the issue related to National Health Laboratory Services, specifically the KZN issue, is that members would be aware that there's a dispute between NHLS and KZN Health in terms of what NHLS say that KZN Health owes them, and what KZN Health says that they don't owe. And it's mainly in simple terms related to the flat fee issue and the signing of the service level agreement. That KZN says, when we started, and we were the last SKZN to go into this NHLS Arrangement Act, there was a service level agreement which was saying we must pay flat fee per month. So they were paying 34 million per month, and everybody was happy. Until the time where NHLS was saying, then the years, was it 3 years or 5 years, has expired. Now we need to go into fee for service. Now KZN Health said, okay, let's discuss the fee for service. for us to pay fee for service, you need to break down your costing and blah, blah, and then we need to say to US Health, you are using our facilities and what. So discount that. So that's where the dispute is. So as a result, KZN Health continues to pay the flat fee until that matter is resolved, and it hasn't been resolved yet. So there's an amount that NHLS in their books will say we are owed, and Health says we don't owe you. So that's what we are busy with. There are two processes, if members are not aware. Members are aware about the minister process, which is the arbitration one. It has been concluded, but the information is not yet put in public. They have submitted a report to the minister. On the other hand, there is a process which I'm involved in, where the DG, after discussion with the minister, requested the accountant general at National Treasury to assist Health National and province to finalize whether there is something owed or not. And I am directly involved in that project, and we are expecting a report to the minister by the end of November, which will be objective, irrespective of whatever the outcome of the arbitration. It will be saying, in terms of plain evidence, these requests were made by the facility and NHLS provided the service, and therefore here's the bill. So that is the exercise we are busy with. We are just reconciling. So where there's evidence, KZN will have to pay. Where there's evidence that there was no requisition from from KZN Health, then that's where the dispute will have to be put to another level. We don't know whether it will be legal or what. Legal has been mentioned before, but that's where we are. So a report will be finalized by the end of November, and it will be given to the minister to make his decision. That's where NHLS is. With the Gauteng one, they have agreed to pay what they think they owe, but it's the same story, but it's got nothing to do with SLA and flat fee. With them, it's just reconciliation. And there's evidence that there were cases where, after reconciliation was done by an independent service provider, there were anomalies that were picked up, and NHLS owned up and refunded. So those are the challenges related to NHLS. When it comes to the Section 100, specifically for Limpopo, I'm sure the COO can assist me with this one, but to answer it in a very short way, is that where we are sitting, we cannot guarantee, member, we cannot give you guarantee that we can say 100% that there will be healthcare services, quality healthcare services, based on the findings that we have found. Over and above the work that the COO is doing, I'm also, other than being the administrator, I'm the team leader for the facility improvement team for the Vembe district. And we visit facilities to see level of care, quality, whether the facility is actually functional, and what are the challenges, whether there's good management, equipment, maintenance, all the issues that were audited by HST, Health System Trust. We have picked up simple issues, simple basics, as the COO will confirm. In one facility, there are no toilet rolls. In one facility, there's no soap. There's no this. Those are basics in terms of quality of services. And some of them, as the Honorable Member is saying, are not necessarily related to availability of funding. Yes, they do have problems with funding, but some of them are pure poor management issues. So that is what we are working on in Limpopo. And I'm sure it's not only Limpopo. There must be some other provinces that are going through the same challenges. Yes. Thank you, Chair. Oh, sorry. Okay, the skills levy for health and welfare sector at national, yes, we are utilizing it. For instance, maybe members are aware that we have recruited almost 400 unemployed graduates at national health. and we have spread them across provinces with the exclusion of one province, now two, that did not want to participate. Okay, the first one is Western Cape. They said they don't need that because they have their own programs, because we all know that all other departments do have an internship program anyway. So the key focus of these particular ones was for national to assist the provinces to respond to audit findings. So it made sense for Western Cape to say to us that they won't participate because they are unqualified and they've been unqualified consistently. However, Northwest was unqualified and they took them, and unfortunately now they are qualified. And then Mpumalanga, we deployed the interns. They went there for about a week and they were sent back off. We had to take them out of the situation because it was not safe for them to be there because they were picketing by internal staff. And there was a whole process with the unions and all that. So we withdrew them from Mpumalanga, and we spread them, and Limpopo benefited in National Health and CCOT on the group that we sent to. So it was on average about 45 interns per province. Mm-hmm. So we did get a refund from Skills Levy, yes sir. So we are participating, and it's not only on this one. On a yearly basis, we do participate. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Tanya. I don't think you'll get questions, Ian. But maybe we can add one question. Why Northwest reversed? So you'll be the one who can answer. But just another comment, Tanya. You know, if you were taking over a particular province, a particular department, obviously those people never came to you and said, we want you to take us over. So they don't want to be taken over. And they, obviously the next step that is going to happen is that if you go in by force, they're going to sabotage you. Now, were you prepared, I think, to put the question in another way, were you prepared for the sabotage that is going to happen when you were taking them over? And prepare yourself that, okay, we're going to be sabotaged by those guys. Let's prepare ourselves so that if they sabotage us, this is what we're going to do. But let's leave Ian to answer.
I think the question was, do we do financial reviews? We do, actually. We do them on a monthly basis. And they're being done at two levels. First is in terms of the PF matter, Section 40, the India monitoring to Treasury. We do those up to a program and even a sub-program level. But we also present at our standing senior management team meetings on a monthly basis the finances up to a sub-program level. We also indicate the conditional grants, the donor funding. So all of that gets presented. I think the issue is we need to get those corrective measures and the fast tracking of some expenses. So that's where we're at. And we review it monthly and we put up those recommendations. We've also introduced something now where we request line managers to take responsibility and do their own projections on a monthly basis. So we give them the actuals up to, say, June and expect them to populate the expected expenditure over the period. The other question that was asked was about the business plan. The question specifically, if I recall it nicely, it was, is that the framework says that you have to sign off these business plans by the end of February, in anticipation of April. I think these were signed off in the first week or third week of April, and that's why the query came, and that's why it became a finding in terms of compliance to the DORA. There could be many reasons and many mitigating reasons. Provinces need to submit those business plans. They need to be reviewed. They need to be sent back workshop. But I think we've taken the view now that the DORA is very clear on what needs to be done at which time. And we've put up some schedule and some system to make sure that we address those DORA requirements consistently in the financial year. So it's not something that we'd like to see, because this is a peer compliance control issue. Should I attempt the one on Northwest? their biggest qualification now again was on the assets, and something that they never had before in terms of qualification. And there's two main reasons that we think that, you know, why it happened. Firstly is that, if you recall, they were always on a Walker system. The Walker was a financial management system. Mm-hmm. And they've actually decided to abolish it, you know, promise-wise. That's what we made to understand. So they went back to a more manual system for looking at assets. And I think the bigger problem for them was also just the normal BAS payments. For long, they couldn't, you know, in the first quarter of last year, they couldn't actually do lots of payments because there wasn't this rollover to BAS.
Mm.
It was a bit of a problem for them. And I think this is the one thing that really caught them. The second thing was that their CFO was actually seconded to the Department of Public Works as an HOD.
Mm.
So it left a big void in terms of the leadership on the financial management in the department. So far as those were the two main reasons why they regressed into a qualified opinion. And hopefully, you know, he's back now, so hopefully we'll be able to pick it up again.
Maybe the other one is that 100% resident went to and became a politician. She was working there, and it was good when she was working there.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. The question about the Nursing Council, there is a unit in the department that monitors the performance and governance of each of the statutory councils. So the Health Professions Council, Nursing Council, the Pharmacy Council, Allied Health Professions Council, etc. So they need to supply to us on a quarterly basis their financials, the strategic plan, their operational plans, their achievement of targets in line with that, etc. We, in addition to that, also attend their council meetings so that we can understand what are the challenges at council level. In terms of the Nursing Council, there certainly is a disciplinary committee, but I think there are some functional challenges about the way the disciplinary committee currently operates. So I think that's part of the problem about how the issues of discipline are dealt with. See, I also wanted to maybe address a little bit the issue around the private medical schools. I think the other challenge with having a private medical school is that, remember, if you create a private medical school, the private medical school needs to attract resources by way of lecturers. And the only way they can do that in an environment where there's limited resources is to pay higher salaries. And what they will then do is destabilize your public institutions of training for medical schools, because they'll attract people into that. So that's quite a big challenge. Now, most countries don't go the route of a private medical school. What they do is they have differential financing of medicine or any other profession. So what they would do is have full financing of a student that agrees to establish a contract with the state to work for the state for a period of time. So in other words, if you're a student that gets accepted into medical school, you'll be funded from first year to sixth year, and you would then work off a period of time as a result of that. And as a result of that, you don't pay fees, or you pay a very small fee. Those students that decide, I'm not going to accept that financing system, I want to pay my way, pay the full fee, you pay the full fee, and you have no obligations at the end of it. So that differential financing can then offer the capital investment to the existing institutions to expand their platform, because existing institutions can expand their platform. It's a financial issue about them having the resources to expand the lecture theatres, additional sites, etc., which is then means that everyone gets an education which is acceptable, there's no instability, and then people who choose to not work for any contract with the state thereafter do so, and those who want to can do so as well. Thank you.
Okay, John, tell me.
Thanks. Yes, the telemedicine strategy was adopted by the Department of Health in 1998, and since then a total of 101 telemedicine sites have been established across the country, 87 of which are in the predominantly rural provinces, and very few of them are in Gauteng in the Western Cape. Because you have more sites where the greater need is. And there are ongoing discussions now between the South African Telemedicine Association of South Africa and the Health Professions Council to address some of the issues that the HPCSA has raised. for instance, about the fact that telemedicine involves people who are not registered with the council. For instance, people responsible for information and communication technology, and that they need a guarantee that the healthcare practitioner practicing telemedicine will ensure that the non-healthcare personnel members do not violate patient confidentiality in the transaction of, in the implementation of telemedicine. The one issue that HPCSA has raised is who takes responsibility when the technology fails? Is it the healthcare practitioner who's practicing telemedicine? Is it the company that manufactured the device or equipment that was used? Is it the facility that purchased it? Or is it, you know, the specialist on the other side who recommended that this be used? These are not insurmountable issues. SADMA, South African Telemedicine Association of South Africa, and HPCSA, in ongoing dialogue about these matters. Only in, well, early in October, HPCSA shared with us their general ethical guidelines for good practice in telemedicine, and SADMA has given them comments. But in the meantime, the department has continued the implementation of telemedicine.
Thanks, Chief. Just to round up the last few things, on devices for medical male circumcision, we'll only adopt those that are pre-qualified by WHO. And at the moment, there are two that are undergoing review by the WHO. With respect to TB in the Western Cape, you know, it's quite interesting. There was a researcher from Imperial College in London. We showed an association between the sun, vitamin D, and increased respiratory diseases. So there is a relationship. What it means, no one knows, but there is a correlation between those two. But the exact cause-effect relationship is unclear. With respect to devolution of services to municipalities, you know, Honourable Member, we did all the technical work on this. This is a political decision. We must just make a political decision, and that lies with you, you know, with the parliamentarians. There are pros and cons, you know, so, and depending on who you ask, they will give you a list of pros and a list of cons. But what one thing is certain, that the split in function is not helping service delivery. That is certain. So we need to make a decision one way or the other, but it's a political decision. I can't do any more technical work because we've done the technical work from 1996-97 already, as you know. And I can give you some very concrete examples of why this is creating a problem. You know, if you take a Tegwini, a third of the TB cases in the entire KwaZulu-Natal is in Tegwini. Who sees patients there? Both the municipality and the province. They will come to the Lancers Road, the old Lancers Road clinic, there near the bus stop. They will be initiated on treatment there. Then they're lost to follow-up, because then they will go to Claremont to continue their treatment. So we don't know where they are, because we're not following patients through any kind of tracking system. And that's happening everywhere, including here. So it's a big problem we need to address. In terms of the common PHC platform, you know, unfortunately, we have a quasi-federal state. You know, we can deny it as much as we want. I'll also like to deny it, but provinces pretty much are doing their own thing. That's the reason we have this norms and standards approach. So we're going back to the norms and standards approach and setting outcomes. So it's an outcomes-based approach. So it doesn't matter how you allocate your resources, as long as you show the outcome that we're all looking for. You know, reduced maternal mortality, reduced infant mortality, and that kind of. So we're not quite there in getting any kind of uniformity. Now, the minister is trying to get uniformity through the non-negotiables and the norms and standards approach. You know, because as the Honourable Canary says, the minister is not the boss of the MECs; they account to the premiers. So there's a challenge in that respect. With respect to the new institution in Durban, Honourable Chair, I didn't see you there, but I'm sure you were there. You went there because it's your alma mater. So what happened there is that the Harvard Hughes Medical Institute gave the University of KwaZulu-Natal, the medical school, $40 million to put up a state-of-the-art research institute. So it's called KRIF, KwaZulu-Natal Research Institute for TB and HIV. So they're supposed to do groundbreaking research for the whole country, not just for KZN. And they've got, you know, state-of-the-art labs and all of that. So it's a very exciting development. The minister went to open it, the premier was there, etc. With respect to the cancer register, it's up and running, but there's a bit of a backlog, so there's a delay. It's now a legal requirement in terms of the Gazette that everybody has to report. is housed currently in the National Institute of Occupational Health, NIOH, and the NHLS. And the National Department co-funds it. So the quality of the data will improve over time as we improve the reporting and the monitoring. So I think we'll be getting somewhere there because, you know, we left it to die, actually, for many years. On the baby-friendly initiative, honorable member, it's now called the Baby and Mother-Friendly Initiative. The reason it's a small number is because we send national teams to go and assess, and we don't have the capacity to do more than the 25 annually. But all facilities are supposed to use the criteria and implement a baby-friendly, baby and mother-friendly environment. But the actual inspection is done by a national team to ensure that the same standard is used everywhere. And because of capacity, we only select a smaller number to accredit each year, which I guess is something we should do a little bit more about. And then the last issue about cervical cancer, Honorable Chair, it's something that we are quite aware of, that we are not doing enough. See, every HIV-positive patient on treatment goes to have abscess. So already we're supposed to have, you know, have a large program on cervical cancer. The other problem, of course, is that if we move from visual inspection to cytology, the costs increase dramatically. And then once you find a problem, you need to be able to treat it. So there's quite a few challenges around cancers generally, but cervical cancer in particular. But we are working with the Cancer Association quite closely. In fact, there's a new Cancer Alliance who are raising issues about access to treatment as well. So, Chair, I will summarize by saying that I think the team tried to do our best in terms of answering the very important questions and probing questions that the honorable members asked. Those areas that we didn't give you full answers for, the way we promised you lists for on the Cuban doctors and on the non-negotiables, we will make sure that we send it to you within a week because we've got all that data. And if there are any other questions that we didn't answer to your satisfaction, please let us know and we will send it to you in writing. But thank you very much for this opportunity on behalf of my colleagues.
So thank you very much, Jochen. I think the humility and the way that the questions have been answered, I'm sure the members are satisfied. And it seems as if the team that you brought was ready, all of them. You brought exactly those that are going to be able to answer questions. And everybody, except for one who didn't talk, but even the one who didn't talk, but we know that is part of you. I'm not talking about Joe, I'm talking about the person who caused the problem with our computer. Maybe he's afraid that he's going to be fired, but you can fire him and you'll get back to one person. Members, that was the Department of Health. They've actually given us what they've been doing last year. Now it's up to you to see where there are areas that you want to make recommendations, if you do have. I must say, there's no doubt about it, that at least there's some positive direction that the department is taking. But it doesn't mean that there are no challenges. There are still challenges. And we're going to definitely make some findings. One of the things, if I can mention a few of the things that we think that we're going to make findings on. You know, as it has been said by members, that the Department of Health is not Department of Public Health only. It's a Department of Health that involves even the private healthcare. And we seem not to have data from the private healthcare. Neither do we seem to have a good relationship with them. Yet we continue talking about public-private partnership. So I think it's something that we need to look into. We don't want your responses now. It's just a summary. On the circumcision, we understand the devices, but I think this is an area where we need to try and educate people, especially the traditional leaders. And there are areas where some of these things are not done deliberately by certain people because they don't believe in them. Yet the reason for doing it is another one, but we're going to make a finding on that one too, but we'll make recommendations. The training of health professionals, we seem to be wanting in the training of health professionals, both internationally and internally, because we do have universities, but we don't think they're working to capacity for obvious reasons, even the criterion of choosing who should do what, it's a very difficult one, because I imagine a situation, if I qualified in Tino, I don't want to mention Solo, because on TV today, there's somebody who stole a baby in Gauteng, and he was formed in Solo, that's where I come from. And unfortunately, now I don't want to mention my small village, but if I'm coming from that small village, if I go to school there, and I get a C aggregate, it means if I had gone to a private good school, I would have got an A. Now, when I go to VET, they consider my C to be a C, and I compete with a white kid who's got an A coming from a better school. So these are some of the things that need to be considered, but we'll make a finding. I think much as you have answered the primary healthcare problem between local and provincial, I think it's a very serious challenge, and it's something that needs to be looked at. The National Health Laboratory Services, we definitely need to amend that act. I think that's where we need to go. I understand what KZN is doing, but I think we need to amend it so that it could be understandable what is it for, because it seems as if it's going another direction. The revitalization of institutions, one always thinks that the NHI has got to do with revitalization of your institutions, especially the public institutions. But you get worried that if I revitalize this building, it takes 10 years. The life span of this building takes 10 years. Now, if we're saying that NHI will kick in at 14 years and we're revitalizing, we're not revitalizing everything. We're doing certain ones. By the time we get to 14 years, some of those that were revitalized today, the lifespan will be finished. We have to go back to them. So I think we need to find a way of how do we talk of NHI and how do we revitalize these institutions in such a way that when we talk of NHI in 14 years, it's just going to kick in and it will be it. The cancer register, we understand what you say, but I think there's we're talking on one side, we're talking of lack of skills, or we're not training doctors. I think it becomes worse when you come to people with histologies, those who can look at the cell and decide this is cancer or this is not cancer. And I think the challenge is in that level. Do we have enough pathologists who can look at that histology? And this is where we need, you can't just say somebody because I've got a lump is a cancer. You need to have a pathologist to look at that and confirm that. And if we've got lack thereof, then it means we're not going to reach what we want to reach. Otherwise, you'll misdiagnose. You'll say there's more cancer, only to find that it's less. Or you say it's less, only to find that there's more cancer. So it's something that we need to tie up with the training of the doctor. And that goes to the depression. I said there's no word for depression in African languages. It shows how mental health for me, coming from rural areas, it's somebody who's mad. There's nothing, it's either you're mad or you're normal. Yet there are so many things like your depression, your mania, anxiety, all those, but we don't have words for those things. All we have is that we are lying alone now. And it talks to psychiatrists in South Africa. And even primary mental health with the, because you go to this, but in fact I saw something that I could not believe in Umtata, where somebody was not a psychopath, but was a schizophrenia, was walking in the street and just tackled one lady and got on top of her to rape her in front of people. But it's understandable that person was mad. And the same person, when he woke up from there, he started eating people's cars. Now, you can't take that person to court because that person is mentally abnormal. And they're walking around the street. It's worse in Umtata. The reason why is because there's somebody who claimed that he could cure them. Now, they go there to try and get the cure, but they end up staying there. So there's so many of them. I think it's something that we need to work on. The HIV, there's something, I'm not sure whether they've done an analysis, but it is going to be a finding on our side that if you make an analysis, most of the money that goes towards HIV including this, what Ian is giving these provinces, it goes to treatment. It doesn't go to prevention. And if you could be preventing it, it would be far much better. I'm sure you could help us, Ian, and look into that. How much money? Somebody told me that it goes into billions that go to treatment.
Three quarters of the conditional grants
goes to treatment. And there's very little that goes to preventing this. Fortunately, we've got an HIV and AIDS committee, which is going to be seeing you very soon. The litigation, it handles a lot of things. Maybe UNBAN would have to help us, but we'll make a finding on this. But these statutory bodies, like the SPCSA, the South African Nursing Council, and others, are they really doing their job in making sure that we get good professionals that are going to handle our people? It's worse when you hear that there's a neurosurgeon that has operated people in Pretoria, operating people, continuing, and that person has been registered by the SPCSA. I think there's another error that we're going to make a finding. But that does not mean that we have done badly. These are some of the findings that we've had. But what you must always remember, the more good you do, the more challenges come. And the more challenges come, the more work. In any case, one time I was in Durban, and I was called to see a patient. And I was phoned to say, in fact, I was phoned by the patient itself on a Sunday, saying that, "Doctor, I've collapsed in the market, you know that market in Durban. Now, and I've had a bypass. Now I'm sick, can you come and see me?" I said, "Okay, go to Wentworth, I'll go and meet you there." And I went to Wentworth. When I got to the duty room, it was on a Sunday. There were no cell phones that time, it was the police. When I was going to the nurses to ask them, "Where is the patient?" I saw somebody sitting there smoking. And I went inside and I said, "Sister, somebody phoned me." They said, "No, he's sitting outside." I went outside, I went to him, I said, "Chief, you told me that he had a heart attack and you were operated, and now you're smoking outside." And he said, "Hey, look, Chief," it was on a Sunday, you can imagine. He said, "Chief, leave me alone to smoke. If I don't smoke, I won't get sick. If I don't get sick, you won't have work. So leave me alone to smoke." Thank you very much, sir. Thank you, members. Thank you, department. By the way, members, I'm requesting you, this is for the members, I'm requesting that the BRI has got a deadline. The budget review and recommendation has got a deadline. We are supposed to have done this thing and completed it by Friday this week, so that it goes to Parliament, it goes to the ATC. But we have requested that we can't we do it next week? So we are requesting that, but we're going to confirm it. We're requesting that on Wednesday, instead of not having a meeting, can you come and adopt the prayer? And we'll ask you, Mresi, to lead the delegation on Wednesday. The delegation of Parliament. You lead the delegation of Parliament on Wednesday, because I won't be there. So we are requesting all the members to come, because we'll be adopting this pre-report as it's needed. So it's a request, members. I'm not forcing you, but I'm really begging you to be here on Wednesday. Wednesday at 9:30. Thank you very much, everybody. It's so sorry that we didn't have food, but all of you are watching your weight, so we don't really need a lot of food. Without water, there's no water. Which water, whiskey or...